Welcome to The Debate. You know, if you were to walk into a greenhouse and find a plant with, like, yellowing, withered leaves, your first instinct wouldn't be to simply grab a brush and paint the leaves green.
Right. I mean, obviously not.
You wouldn't just isolate a single leaf, put it under a microscope, diagnose it with something like yellow leaf syndrome, and then completely ignore the dry, depleted soil it's planted in.
Exactly. Because intuitively, we know the plant and the soil are in this continuous active relationship. You check the water, the mineral content, the sunlight, you know, the temperature of the room. You look at the context.
Yes. But then you step into the world of modern human health, and suddenly we are intensely focused on painting the leaves.
Yeah.
So today we are taking a hard look at the fundamental unit of human health. We are examining whether the traditional biomedical model, which, you know, treats the patient as an isolated biological machine, is fundamentally flawed.
Which is a pretty massive question.
It is, and we'll be debating if it should be replaced by what is called the field of viability framework. This is a model that evaluates the developing person in field.
Right, and it's a profound shift in how we think about what a patient actually is and what it really means to heal someone.
It's a total paradigm shift. So let's establish exactly where we stand on this source material. I'll be arguing that health must be redefined as life course viability.
Mm-hmm.
We need to use what the framework calls a 7 primitive diagnostic grammar to fully integrate the biological, the social, and the ecological determinants into one unified diagnostic model.
And I take the opposing perspective here. While context is obviously crucial, expanding the unit of health to include entire political, economic, and ecological fields risks, well, diluting our clinical precision.
Okay.
I'll be arguing that this framework overwhelms practical medicine, and frankly, unintentionally erases the individual agency it's trying to protect.
Well, let's start by looking at where medicine currently stands, because we have to give credit where it's due, right?
Sure.
The dominant biomedical model is undeniably brilliant for acute, localized issues. If I have a fractured femur, or a bacterial infection, or a ruptured appendix.
You want a hospital.
I absolutely want the biomedical model. I want the reductionism that isolates the organ, takes an image of the problem, and surgically fixes it.
Because the reductionist model is the greatest triumph of modern science. I mean, it isolates variables to find the exact mechanism of failure.
It does, yes. But that exact model is failing spectacularly when it comes to addressing the chronic, field-generated burdens of our time. I'm talking about the explosion of diabetes, childhood asthma, chronic mental distress.
Complex multimorbidity, yeah.
Exactly. Right now, the standard medical response to these systemic issues is to just, like, add a list of social determinants to the patient's chart. Like, check a box if the patient is experiencing housing insecurity. But adding a passive list to the background is completely insufficient.
Because you think it doesn't go far enough in integrating those factors into the actual diagnosis.
It doesn't even come close. The living body doesn't just passively exist inside an environment. It is continuously transducing its environment.
Transducing.
Yeah. And by transducing, I mean the body is taking the outside world and literally converting it into internal biology.
Right.
The chronic stress of housing insecurity or the biological impact of commercial food systems, it isn't just happening around the person. It's being converted into physiology through neuroendocrine and immune pathways.
Okay, I see where you're going with this.
That's why the true unit of health has to be the developing person in field. And health itself should be defined as life course viability, like the ongoing capacity to continue, recover, and develop.
I mean, I come at it from a different way. I acknowledge entirely that context profoundly impacts biology. No serious medical professional is debating that poverty and pollution shape health outcomes.
Right.
But I must warn against shifting the foundational definition, the ontology of health, away from the individual biological unit. Treating the person in field as the core diagnostic unit risks what we might call vague contextualism.
Vague contextualism. Break that down for me.
It means that if a patient's metabolic dysfunction is suddenly framed as a symptom of global commercial determinants, local housing policies, and planetary ecologies.
Which it is.
Sure, but the actual acute biomedical pathology gets lost in an unmanageable web of variables. You lose the plot. Furthermore, dissolving the person entirely into a soup of structural determinants risks the structural erasure of agency.
I don't think it erases agency at all.
Well, it does if we leave both our clinicians and our patients paralyzed by overwhelming systemic problems they simply cannot control.
I see why you think that, but let me give you a different perspective. We aren't abandoning the biological pathology. We are simply situating it where it actually lives.
Okay.
Let's look at childhood asthma, which is an example highlighted right in the material. In a narrow clinical frame, asthma is defined as airway inflammation and bronchial hyperresponsiveness.
Right.
The treatment. We prescribe an inhaler.
Which is a highly effective, life-saving intervention.
It is. Nobody is saying throw away the inhaler. But if that child lives in substandard housing with rampant black mold, right next to a major highway producing diesel traffic pollution,
yeah,
and has a caregiver who is suffering from extreme chronic economic stress, you know, that inhaler is a late stage, fundamentally incomplete intervention. The child's body is carrying that toxic field inward.
But it treats the acute symptom.
Sure, but the airway inflammation is literally the physical location where the housing policy, the environmental regulation, and the clinical care meet. Treating the symptom while sending the child back into the very field that generated the disease is exactly why our health systems are constantly overwhelmed.
That is a compelling argument, but have you considered the danger of operational reductionism?
How so?
Let's stay right there with the asthma example. If you conclude that this child's asthma is ultimately a failure of housing policy, zoning laws, and environmental regulation, where does clinical accountability begin and end?
It ends where the field stops harming the child.
But the physician and the clinic cannot redesign urban transit systems. They cannot rewrite tenancy laws or force landlords to remove mold.
No, they can't.
Right. So the biomedical state, what this framework refers to as the X, must remain the primary anchor of medicine. If we demand that health systems expand their diagnostic unit to encompass the entire political economy, those systems will collapse under the weight of trying to govern public policy rather than treating disease. We need boundaries to act effectively.
But the boundaries we have right now are creating a false separation. Think of the human body not as a sealed mechanical engine, but as a selective interface. Much like a cell membrane.
That's a fascinating analogy from the text, yeah.
Right? You cannot understand a single cell's viability without understanding the fluid and the constraints surrounding it in the petri dish. Acknowledging the environment doesn't erase the cell. It explains the cell's behavior.
Sure.
When we ignore the field, we practice a very dangerous, different kind of reductionism. We wait until field conditions have already become physically embodied as pathology. We diagnose the high blood pressure only after years of chronic stress, sleep loss, and vascular strain have done their damage.
I completely understand the desire to map the trajectory. Identifying risks early is the core of preventative medicine.
Yes.
But practically speaking, how does a health professional actually do this without losing their mind? The framework proposes a solution to this operational paralysis through its so-called seven primitives viability grammar.
Which is brilliant.
Well, let's list them. Constraints, margins, state, disturbance, perception, regulation, and options. And it claims this complex new language is superior to our current static list of social determinants.
Because it is vastly superior. A static list of social determinants only tells us what matters. Oh, the patient is in poverty, check the box. But this grammar tells us exactly how it matters mechanically.
Okay.
Let's slow down and look at how this works. Poverty isn't just a label you slap on a chart. The grammar reveals the mechanism of poverty in a specific person's life.
Okay, walk me through how a doctor uses this grammar for a specific patient. Let's say a patient with type 2 diabetes.
Perfect. So we don't just say they are poor. We look at constraints. Poverty functions as a strict constraint on food choice, limiting them to cheap, ultra-processed foods.
Right. The access is constrained.
Exactly. Then we look at margins. Poverty depletes their margins by removing financial buffers. So a single unexpected car repair becomes a life-altering crisis.
Mm-hmm.
Then we look at disturbance. That constant threat of crisis acts as a chronic disturbance that persistently activates the autonomic stress response system, which, by the way, physically alters their metabolism and immune function.
Yeah, the allostatic load.
Exactly. This grammar gives us a portable mechanical language to understand precisely how the field is tearing the person down.
I'm sorry, but I just don't buy that this is functional in the real world.
Why not?
Let me tell you why. Picture a standard 15-minute clinical consultation. The idea of mapping out commercial determinants or institutional perception or evaluating allostatic load using 7 abstract philosophical primitives for a diabetic patient is utterly unwieldy.
It's not abstract.
The physician has 15 minutes. They need to check the HbA1c levels, adjust the insulin dosage, and screen the patient for neuropathy.
But checking the HbA1c is just one of the 7 primitives. That's checking the state.
Exactly. And checking the state is what the doctor is trained to do. Look, I question if this entire grammar simply replaces an old, easily understood checklist of social needs with a far more complex, multi-scale conceptual web that abstractly waves away the immediate biological urgency. It feels like an academic sociology exercise rather than a sharp clinical tool.
Well, it's a good thing it's not meant to be a sociology seminar then. You're missing the scale of the framework. It's a coordination grammar across different sectors of society.
Meaning the doctor isn't the only one using it?
Exactly. The physician in the clinic treats the state, they manage the HbA1c and the neuropathy. But the public health official down the street uses the exact same grammar to look at the community disturbances. Say they identify that the neighborhood is a food swamp dominated by ultra-processed foods.
Okay.
And then the state policymaker uses the exact same grammar to look at constraints, like the fact that insulin is unaffordable.
So it's a shared language.
Precisely. Right now, the doctor, the public health official, and the policymaker speak completely different, isolated languages. The physician writes patient noncompliance in the chart. The social worker writes food insecurity. And the policymaker talks about market access.
Yeah, I see the disconnect there.
The 7 primitives allow them to coordinate their actions around a single unifying question. What preserves, erodes, restores, or expands this person's life capacity?
Okay, the idea of a shared coordination language across sectors is elegant in theory. But let's look at what happens when we apply this multi-scale lens to the actual human being sitting in the exam room.
Sure.
The framework explicitly claims that patient behavior is embodied adaptation, not mere choice.
Yes, it strongly argues that.
It suggests that eating ultra-processed foods or avoiding exercise or smoking is a biological adaptation to fatigue, stress, time poverty, and aggressive commercial marketing.
Which it often is.
Now, I recognize that this removes the historic error of individual blame. Blaming a stressed, exhausted patient for their diet while they live in a food swamp is both cruel and medically ineffective.
Exactly.
But my concern is that this framework dangerously flirts with removing individual responsibility entirely.
How so? Where does it remove responsibility?
Think about the implication. If all metabolic disease is framed as the unavoidable result of commercial food systems, allostatic load, and systemic exhaustion, do we completely strip the patient of their lived agency?
No, we don't.
But by framing their behavior merely as an embodied, automatic response to an overwhelming field, we risk telling the patient they are just a helpless node in a network of structural determinants. To heal, a human being must believe they have the capacity to act. If the field dictates everything, why should the patient even try to change their diet or remember to take their medication?
I'm not convinced by that line of reasoning, because the framework explicitly protects agency. It just refuses to demand agency where it practically cannot exist.
What do you mean?
It replaces the concept of moral blame with distributed responsibility and accurate diagnosis. Think about the final primitive in the grammar. Options.
The pathways available to the patient.
Right.
Options are real, materially accessible pathways for action. A choice is not a real option if it is unaffordable, physically unsafe, or institutionally blocked.
I agree with that.
So, assigning individual responsibility to a patient without providing the actual options, is coercive. It's not medicine. It's moralizing, disguised as medicine.
But doesn't that logic imply we have to fix the entire structure of society before we can expect a single patient to take charge of their health?
Not at all. It just means we stop telling people to swim while completely ignoring the fact that we've dropped them into a riptide.
Okay, that's fair. The framework actually restores genuine, durable agency because it seeks to open real pathways for action. If a patient is failing to manage their diabetes, the viability approach asks, what constraints are operating here? Oh, maybe the medication is too expensive. What margins are depleted?
Right.
Maybe they have zero free time because they are a single parent with intense caregiving burdens. When we identify and address those specific constraints and margins, we give the patient their agency back. We stop delivering useless, moralistic advice that they have no margin to follow.
and we start designing treatments that are actually viable in their real life.
And I completely agree that medical advice must be practically viable. Telling someone working three jobs to cook fresh organic meals every night is absurd.
Exactly.
Where I hesitate is the scaling of this philosophy. When we look at things like complex chronic illness, chronic pain, or extreme fatigue syndromes, the framework suggests these are dysregulated couplings between the person and the institutional, relational, and ecological levels.
Yes.
It asks the physician to validate the suffering by pointing at the field. But diagnostic precision matters. If we expand the definition of a disease to include the patient's relationship with the entire political economy, we risk therapeutic nihilism.
Therapeutic nihilism?
Yeah, the belief that treatment is useless. The doctor might look at the chart and think, well, I can't fix the commercial determinants of health, and I can't fix capitalism, so I can't really heal this patient. The biological tether, you know, the focus on the physical body, is what gives medicine its incredible power to intervene effectively right now, today.
But the biological tether is exactly what the dysregulation loop explains. It shows how the field physically enters the body.
Okay.
Let's talk about how this actually works. When a person faces a chronic disturbance, say severe financial insecurity, and they lack margins like a savings account or a supportive family, they experience overload. Their neurological conception literally narrows to a state of threat.
The fight or flight response.
Exactly. Their biological regulation becomes maladaptive. The brain senses a threat, so the neuroendocrine system pumps out cortisol. Autonomic tone shifts. Chronic inflammation rises. This isn't a metaphor. It is measurable physical allostatic load.
Right.
And what does chronic cortisol do? It raises blood sugar, damages blood vessels, and leads to margin loss, which worsens the biological state, which creates further constraint. The dysregulation loop proves that the political economy is already inside the biology. You cannot separate them.
That mechanism is precisely why I value the concept of allostatic load. It biologically quantifies the literal wear and tear of stress on the organs. But we have to be incredibly careful about what we define as a treatment.
Right.
The framework suggests that true healing is the restoration of viable coupling between person and field. That is a beautiful, holistic, almost poetic sentiment. But in practice, healing often requires aggressive, acute symptom suppression. We need to be careful not to denigrate symptom management in our pursuit of systemic perfection.
Of course.
Pain relief, glucose control, and blood pressure medications are not just painting the leaves, they are keeping the plant alive so it actually has time to grow deeper roots.
And the framework explicitly affirms that. It clearly states that clinical care, including precise diagnosis, medication, and surgery, is a vital, necessary form of state stabilization and repair. It never denigrates symptom suppression when it's necessary to save a life. What it warns against is stopping there.
Stopping at the prescription pad?
Exactly. Let's say you prescribe an anxiolytic to someone experiencing severe, debilitating anxiety. You are successfully suppressing a symptom, and that's good.
Mm-hmm.
But if that person is experiencing anxiety because they are living in a violently abusive home, the field remains incredibly dangerous. You haven't restored viability. You've just muted the body's natural alarm system. True healing must eventually include reducing the disturbance in the field, or it simply isn't healing. It's just maintenance.
I think we find a strong point of convergence there. I certainly agree that sending a patient back into the exact environmental conditions that made them sick is an exercise in futility.
Yeah.
The concept of margins in this grammar is incredibly useful clinically. I've seen this myself. You can have two patients with the exact same diagnosis and the exact same biological state, the exact same lab results, and they can have wildly different prognoses simply because their margins differ.
Exactly.
One has massive physiological reserve, a supportive family, a strong financial buffer, and a flexible job. The other is exhausted, socially isolated, and living paycheck to paycheck. The disease is identical, but their life capacity is entirely different.
Exactly. They have a different capacity to endure the same disturbance. And that brings us to the core ethical test of the entire framework, the life capacity test. It forces us to ask of any condition, any public policy, or any clinical intervention, does this preserve and expand life capacity, or does it disable it?
It's a huge question to ask.
It is, but when we look at health through this wide lens, we realize that human health and ecological viability are deeply, inextricably coupled. A society simply cannot be considered fundamentally healthy if it generates its economic wealth by depleting the ecological margins like clean water, stable climate, biodiversity, that future generations will absolutely rely on for their own survival and viability. That is a massive scope.
To summarize my stance on all of this, while a deep understanding of how social and ecological fields become physically embodied is absolutely crucial for modern medicine, health frameworks must remain firmly tethered to the biological individual.
Okay.
We must preserve diagnostic precision. Because if we dilute the medical model into a generalized, sprawling critique of societal systems, we lose our operational capacity to treat the actual patient sitting in front of us. We must preserve practical individual agency even when facing massive structural constraints.
And to summarize my perspective, true precision requires recognizing that biology is deeply historical and intensely relational. The idea of the isolated individual is a medical fiction. The person in field and the seven primitives grammar provide the only coherent functional way to coordinate real healing across both the clinical and systemic levels. You simply cannot heal a deeply interconnected living system by treating its parts in total isolation.
Well, we certainly agree that modern chronic diseases are fundamentally shaped by cumulative environmental exposures and depleted physiological margins. I mean, the era of the simple single pathogen, single cure paradigm is behind us for the vast majority of the disease burden we face today.
And evaluating health through this broader lens of life capacity forces us to ask deeper ethical questions about the condition-generating systems we actively design and live in. There is so much more nuance to explore in the source material, especially regarding policy applications and intergenerational transmission, but we will leave the listener to form their own conclusions.
Indeed, it forces us to look past the plant and confront the soil.
And if the soil is completely toxic, no amount of green paint will ever bring the leaves back to life.